From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, the second installment in a scheduled series of conversations with Professor Luciana Baum, retired professor from Edinburgh University, a public university based in Edinburgh, Pennsylvania. She's also a film critic, a prolific writer, particularly on topics pertaining to Marxist analysis of history, and is featured regularly at counterpunch.org. Okay, Luciana, well, you know, we left off last week, basically, talking about how the Bolsheviks, unlike many of our fellow Facebook armchair revolutionaries, were faced with the actual task of actually feeding, clothing, housing, and governing the people of first Russia and what became the Soviet Union. And that meant, we're Marxists, of course, certainly focusing on economics. And they had to come up with an economic plan that actually worked and fed, clothed, and housed people, not just sounded good on paper. So let's start there.
Okay. The new economic policy, Lenin described it as a move to state capitalism, but within the worker state of the Soviet Union, which name Soviet Union was adopted in 1922.
Just so people know, because I think this is interesting and even germane after the Occupy thing just happened. Well, Soviet Union, people think of Soviet as some kind of evil demon creature that walked around, but actually a Soviet was a workers' council. It's Russian for workers' council or council. And
That's right.
Soviet Union was essentially a union of workers' councils that had been formed across the country.
Yeah, the Soviets. These Soviets were crucial in 1917, the October Revolution. They were organized, and they were in police, in the factories, etc. So, what you call it, democracy from below?
Yeah, I mean, here we had for Occupy for a moment, which is why I tied it to that. We had assemblies, general assemblies that would meet where,
yeah,
you know, people would just govern themselves in place, more or less. And starting with the Petrograd Soviet back in, it was 1905, 1907, somewhere
That's right.
It took about 10 years for that to become suddenly the mode of organization of society. And what we're describing now, the NEP, or New Economic Program, was, this is what we're talking about it being a quote-unquote step back from.
Yes, that's right. I will be pronouncing it NEP because I like it. So we are beginning in 1921-22. That is 4 years after the October Revolution. So Lenin proposed it to the Party Congress in 1921, and he conceded that it was a strategic retreat from socialism, a step back from central planning, and that it was tied to labor productivity. This is what it included: a free market and capitalism, broadly speaking, but both subject to state control. And he proposed socialist state enterprises that would operate on a profit basis. Now, the new economic policy came after what was known as war communism. And it came after the Russian Civil War of 1918-22. So the NEP was a decision in how to develop a plan for the economy. Now, war communism had these features. It involved the complete nationalization of industry and banking. It had involved, you know, instant nationalization. Yeah. It administered the economy by decree. You know, we have to understand that 1918, World War I was still going on. Yeah. And a civil war was impending. So it administered the economy by decree. Farmers and workers were ordered to produce. Food and goods were issued by decree. And the main thing of war communism is that it relied on forced grain distribution. That is to say...
That's what they called requisition, right, of agricultural surplus.
In other words, forced demand requisition for, food was produced in the country to feed the cities and the army. Right. Now, war communism was an economy operating in extreme emergency. The civil war erupted between the Bolshevik and the whites, fomented by foreign interests, which supported the whites. And the there was a foreign invasion of European states and the United States of Russia. This is funny because we always fear Russia invasion, but it was the United States that invaded Russia.
The United States, Great Britain, France... And everybody had a piece going in there.
Bulgaria, Romania, the Central Powers, too. Yeah.
Exactly.
The whole so-called civilized world descended on this revolution.
And the term of art, I think, that, what's his name, Churchill used, that they wanted to suffocate it in its cradle.
Yes. Right. Yes, he did. So the Civil War was... I'm not emphasizing the emotional aspect of this dreadful thing, but the Civil War disrupted the means of transportation and public services, so food could not be adequately supplied. We're talking 1922. Epidemics of typhus broke out. In 1921, there was a drought and a terrible frost that caused the harvest to fail, and therefore famine. Masses of people died, some say millions. Now, what happened in the north of Russia, in the industrial cities, these cities suffered depopulation by an average of 24%. People fled to the country to look for food. And just to give you an idea, 850,000 people left Petrograd for the country. So these are the conditions. In addition, there was the peace treaty with Germany called Brest-Litovsk. Trotsky was put in charge of the negotiation with Germany for an armistice first and a peace treaty eventually. And Trotsky appointed a deputy with Lenin and Stalin behind him, saying, sign immediately. The peace treaty negotiations started in December of 1917. That's 2 months after October. And the deputy, Trotsky's deputy, didn't sign, came home. The Germans said, okay, we'll think about it and get back to you. Both Lenin and Stalin said, oh, for God's sake, they'll come back. You should have signed right away. They'll come back with enormous demands. And they did in February. And Trotsky himself went to the negotiation. And here, I don't want to get into polemics over Trotsky. It's maybe some other time. But Trotsky's idea presented himself from a position of revolutionary strength, and he proposed something. He told these astonished German negotiators that he stood by no peace, no war, whatever that meant, and they returned. In other words, he wasn't going to sign anything. He expected the German Democratic Party to rise up and continue the world revolution on which he was stuck. And nothing like that happened. The generals, the German negotiators were astonished and went for the throat. And at Brest-Litovsk, Germany demanded, I think it was 30% of the agricultural land and got maybe even close to 40%. And 30 to 40% of the industrial area Russia lost, and 91% of the coal mines. So we had this destruction by civil war, loss of territory and resources by Brest-Litovsk. The peasants in the countryside up in arms about the forced grain requisition. So what to do? What then must we do?
Right.
So Lenin proposed the new economic plan.
Right.
So because, you know, the combined disaster of war, famine and blockade, let's not forget the blockades, convinced Lenin to move to a mixed economy. Several things happened at Brest-Litovsk. I mean, Stalin and Lenin, Stalin was always behind Lenin. The reason why they wanted the peace treaty to be signed is because they were in such a position of weakness and they needed a respite to reconstruct, essentially. So he moved to a mixed economy, and that was approved by the Congress.
And just before we walk away from the peace treaty, one of the primary enabling demands that led to the revolution, both the February and the October revolutions, was a demand for peace, including among the military.
Yes.
What's curious about the treaty that was signed with Germany, the territorial losses included what were then Russian territories at the time of the Baltic states, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, Belarus, and Ukraine.
Yes.
So
yes.
The same things that are being picked off by the United States since 1991, these are the things that were taken at that time by the United States, the UK, and France, along with what's now part of Finland from Russia
exactly.
At that time.
It ironies, yes. Yes, it's the Western powers are regressing to, you know, regressing. They don't call it regressing, but yeah, they're falling back on what you call it, and recapturing what the Russian Revolution had lost,
right?
But then gained through the World War II,
right?
Yeah.
So I'm sorry. So go ahead. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead.
No, that was it. I just wanted to make that point. So go ahead.
Yeah, that point is important to see how the United States is behaving toward Russia is right. Okay. So no, it was a very good point. It has really challenged my thinking. You pinpointed it very well. So what was this mixed economy? Revoking nationalization of industry. It allowed private individuals to own small enterprises. I remember that Tito did this in Yugoslavia in 1970. It amounted to somebody could have a business that employed no more than 15 people. I think in this case it was 20. It's no big deal, you know, but it allowed private individuals to own small enterprises. But the state controlled banks, foreign trade, large industry, something like China now.
Right.
Does it echo with you?
Yeah, it's also sort of what's being experimented with in Cuba.
Exactly. And I would have thought South Africa would have tried it, but it got strangled by the IMF. It chose the IMF.
Yeah, it never got there. Yeah.
Yeah, it never had a real, you know, it ended apartheid. That was about it. So, 1 minute, please.
Sure. Well, I mean, and while you do that, meanwhile, I mean, South Africa never really got to the point where they expropriated the, you know, the people who, the colonialists, they that task lies before them before they can move to diversification of the economy.
Yeah, Dennis Brutus, who was on Robben Island with Mandela, and taught at Pittsburgh, at the University of Pittsburgh, creative writing. And I got him to come up here to talk. He was wonderful.
Ah.
And, you know, he synthesized, I think it was privately to me, the choice of South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
We either go the way of Cuba and blockade or IMF.
Mm. In retrospect,
So what? Sorry,
in retrospect, you wonder because, I mean, probably when we're talking about the way of Cuba for South Africa, you're more likely talking about the way of Zimbabwe. But we're digressing. Let's stay with NEP, NEP.
Yeah, that's what Mobutu. And that's why, what's his name? The head of Zimbabwe. What's his name?
Robert Mugabe, President Mugabe.
Yeah, Mugabe kicked out the IMF. That's why they hate him so much.
Yep.
So, forced grain requisition was replaced by a tax in kind of agricultural produce, and later it was actually rewarded by cash. The NEP also introduced monetary reforms and solicited investment by foreign capital. Now, I argue that this policy came out of the necessity of the material condition. Some say that Lenin followed Marx's idea that, you know, his idea, quote, the full maturation of capital was the prerequisite for socialism. You can't skip the phase of capitalism in order to go to socialism. Is what Marx stated. But Lenin was a very practical person, and he acted out of material condition, out of what he called objective conditions. So, he read his Marx, but this was also a response to the specific crisis of the state that came out of the revolution.
Right, and you had listed some of those conditions. By the way, there's one additional one. You had, aside from the conditions that you listed, you had also a drought and some problem, essentially a famine. That you had a crisis in food production, which caused also unrest in the cities over the food supply issue. So that also exacerbated the conditions that required this solution.
Yes, absolutely. Because what happened was that when the peasants started to be paid in cash, there was a whole relationship between production and consumer goods. The prices were rising. Production was not keeping up. But the moment that that Lenin instituted the pay in cash production and allowed surplus to be sold on markets, then production rose. So in a way, the peasants were holding back or were being resentful and were holding back some of the, weren't producing fast enough on purpose, some hoarding. But you're right. In 1921, there was this discrepancy, this added problem.
Right.
So the critical elimination of forced requisition of grain had been fueling social unrest too. In fact, it was a class sort of unrest. The industrial workers and the peasants had different aims.
Right.
You know, they were put in conflict. So that was a threat to the revolution because the two classes that emerged that benefited from the Bolshevik revolution were the industrial workers, 5% of the country, and the peasants, 80% of the country.
Right. I mean, you look at the logo, right? Look at the logo. The hammer and sickle represent the industrial workers and the peasantry.
Yes, that's exactly right. So forced grain requisition was replaced by a tax in kind at first of agricultural produce, and later paid in cash. And the NEP introduced monetary reform and solicited investment by foreign capital. Now, as I said a minute ago, Lenin followed, supposedly, ideologically followed Marx's diktat, which wasn't a diktat,
right.
That, you know, socialism must come after capitalism. This, by the way, I keep interjecting, this idea that socialism must come out of after capitalism greatly concerned, agitated, post-independent African nations, in particularly in Kenya, Watyongo, the writer, Ngugi Watyongo, did ask the question, where do we go now in 1960? You know, do we go back to tribalism, that colonization has ended? Or do we move to capitalism and then socialism and have with capitalism all the horror that that implies? Where do African nations go? You know?
And this is something that's on the agenda for just about every nation state that emerges from imperialism. Do we go back to status quo anti-imperialism, or do we accept what's happened and move forward from where we are now?
Yeah. And it seems that, and of course, we see this was also a concern for Russia, and it was debated. You know, it was debated on whether, I think Bukharin, for example, opposed, as I will get to, I'm skipping here, but Bukharin, for example, opposed rapid industrialization. So there was a great deal of debate within the party over how to get to socialism. So anyway, enforced industrialization was the response to crisis at home and threats from abroad to the survival of the revolution. And Lenin and his followers saw the NEP as an interim measure, that is a measure to get a respite both from the devastation of the civil war and the choking from abroad. The NEP was repealed in 1928, just so that I don't forget to say it.
Right.
It was repealed by Stalin in 1928. Yet industrial production under NEP, which had been 12% before the revolution, rose to 40% in 1924, and the year of Lenin's death. It is said that the NEP succeeded in creating an economic recovery after the devastation of World War I, the Russian Revolution, and the Russian Civil War. By 1925, in the wake of Lenin's NEP, a major transformation was occurring politically, economically, culturally, spiritually. Small-scale and light industries were largely in the hands of private entrepreneurs or cooperatives. And by 1928, agricultural and industrial production had been restored to the 1913 pre-World War I level.
Right.
So there was, however, an opposition within the party to NEP. Trotsky, supported by the left-wing members of the Communist Party, saw NEP as the relinquishment of state control. They demanded a fully planned economy and full control by the state of distribution of goods. They also saw it as a compromise of communist principles. Now, at first, Stalin sided with the right wing of the party in calling for a state-run capitalist economy.
That's right.
State-run capitalist economy. But he complied with the Lenin plan and implemented the first five-year plan of the NEP policy. Now, here, I was going to mention Lenin's left-wing childishness, his essay in April 19, lambasting the Mensheviks.
Yeah.
But maybe that will come up.
Yeah, we're talking about left-wing communism and infantile disorder, if I remember
right.
correctly.
That's right. Yes. In which he attacked mainly these illusions of, let's march forward to world revolution attack. And he said, with what? With cardboard swords?
Right.
I mean, we are so weak. And he, in that essay, which is marvelous, and I do recommend reading it, and it's very clear, and he quoted Clausewitz, and the balance of forces. How can we mount a world revolution, international revolution, when we're so weak? We should really be withdrawing to the Urals if necessary, which Stalin then did. At least he moved the industries in World War II.
Right.
And, the usual, it's a Russian tactic. Do not attack, wait to be attacked, regroup, go somewhere safe, and you have the back of this vast country. You have this vast country in the back of you. Come out of that strong.
Which is what they did. Yep. And I think that parallels the economic strategy. And we're going to have to stop here for this week. Essentially, what we've done is to set up for next week the role that the NEP played. Because at the end of this, coming into World War II, Lenin dies in early 1924. Stalin consolidates power, and by 1928 is reversing course, rapid industrialization and rapid collectivization of the agricultural sector. And Russia is actually able to defeat Germany in World War II as a consequence of all of these things. And that's where I guess we can pick it up, develop this further next week and pick it up there.
Yeah, that would be wonderful, because Stalin really, to just end with a quote, actually he mounted a second revolution. I mean, he continued Leninism, and he did four things that I want to talk about next time. What it meant to have socialism in one country, why that would work. How that depended on providing rapid industrialization, how the industrialization depended on increasing agriculture, and how that required the coordination of the two, industrial growth and agricultural production, by centralized planning. Those 4 points, there were three proposals, Trotsky, Bukharin, and eventually Stalin, of how to move socialism forward, socialist economy forward.
Good, and we
and
can...
Stalin is the one that triumphed.
That's right, it did, and thankfully, because I think it had a major effect on the world going forward. All right, Luciana Bohn, thank you very much, and we'll speak with you again next week.
My pleasure, Dan, thank you.
Thank you. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.